Hello, and welcome to Top of Mind Florida.
I'm Brian Crowley, and with me is my co-host, Michael.
Whoops. Michael Williams is not here because Michael Williams decided he was going to go on vacation in Alaska. So the burden is all on me. Thanks, Michael. Anyway, my guest today is Phil DiComo, a renowned nonprofit lawyer who also worked for WXEL early in his career. Phil, welcome.
Thanks, Brian. I appreciate being here.
So a lot has been happening in the PBS radio and TV industry with the cuts from federal funding, cuts from state funding.
It's been a whirlwind.
A lot about that stuff. So tell us a little bit about your experience with WXEL.
Well, so it's interesting. My first job out of college was working in public broadcasting down in Miami at WPBT. So I spent the first 15 years of my career working in the nonprofit sector, primarily in public media. So I worked at WPBT. I later worked at WXEL, so Miami, West Palm, television and radio. And in 2015, I was the attorney who did the merger of WXEL and WPBT to create South Florida PBS.
So what led you into that industry? When you I believe Michael and you graduated from the same school.
Surprised
you. If Michael
right,
were here, you'd
Gators,
be doing the Gator
right.
thing. Very interesting thing. Think I'd be teamed up against with you two guys. So help me. You understand these things. I went to the University of South Florida. It's in Tampa.
Right.
You grew up in South Florida.
Which is
how in the world did a college in Tampa become South Florida?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how that happened. That's why I went to Gainesville. Just didn't have to deal with that debate or try to figure that out.
So anyway, what kinds of impact are the budget cuts from the feds and the state having on the public radio and television?
So they're very impactful, and I don't know that we know the full story just yet because it's so early on. Stations in Florida have been dealing with state funding cuts for a number of years. At one point, they were zeroed out, and then the state government, the legislators, realized that all of their exposure on media came through public broadcasting. Even getting on local commercial channels came through Florida Public Broadcasting, because that's who was actually doing the taping in Tallahassee. So they immediately reversed course and put some funding back so that their faces could be on local media again in their local constituencies. So, but the funding was cut drastically. So we've been dealing with lower and lower amounts of funding from the state for a while now. Stations have adjusted to that. The climate changed this year from a federal standpoint, first with the attacks on the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the executive orders, challenges to the executive orders, trying to remove board members from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and now ultimately the rescission. And the important thing about the rescission is that public broadcasting is funded 2 years in advance. It was set up that way purposely by Congress when public media was created in the 60s, so that local stations couldn't be impacted immediately. It would be a two-year window for budget cuts to take effect. So the rescission was essentially undoing all of that. The rescission said, even though you've been funded for 2 years, we're going to now defund the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and take away the money that's already been promised to you. So that's what's happening. That's what just happened most recently when the House and the Senate voted to rescind the funds that were already provided to the public broadcasting through the CPB.
Why should anyone care?
So there's a lot of reasons, and I don't think public media has done a good job explaining to the American public what their role is. If you take part in some of the things that public broadcasting offers, like if you happen to be someone who didn't graduate from high school and you didn't have access to a GED program through your school system or locally, you may have had access through your public television station. And that may be the thing that got you prepared for to take your GED exam and to get that equivalency diploma. So then you understand it if you're that person, right? But perhaps you're not that person, or the elderly who gets special education or training, or the shut-in who only gets the kind of entertainment programming, classical music, things like that through public media. So it serves very small audiences, but lots of very small audiences in really instrumental ways. The other thing that public broadcasting does is it's the backbone of our emergency broadcasting system. And people don't realize that there's an infrastructure that has to take place, and it's built in our public media system. So it's really important to all of Americans. It should be.
Well, explain that a little bit more about the emergency broadcasting system part of it. Why is that the only source for emergency broadcasting, and why is that important?
So if you think about it particularly, you've heard a lot probably about stations in Alaska who deal with all kinds of issues and emergencies, flooding. There was one recently, and there was a tsunami warning. The people who worked at the station, one of the stations in Alaska, were in the tsunami zone. They stayed broadcasting so that the people there could get the warnings. They were the only source for that in that area. So there's all kinds of examples of where it's really, really critical for the people in those constituencies.
Republicans have long made the argument that public broadcasting is largely a liberal attack the conservatives outlets. Are they wrong?
So, you know, you can have whatever opinion you want to have about any media. I think if you look at it as a whole, I think public broadcasting really focuses on credibility and ethics in journalism. But there's all kinds of layers to this argument. Public broadcasters, particularly National Public Radio, has had the greatest number of attacks. One of the things that NPR is really focused on is getting all voices on the air. So they reach out to the left, they reach out to the right, and they let the people speak. And I think some of the attacks are critical because you have voices on the left and they ignore the fact that they also have voices on the right. So, you know, I think people can make their own conclusions as to whether the media is biased. But I think the other thing you have to consider is that the news is a small component of public media. Arts and education gets to people largely through public media. I can't tell you how many times I've seen messages from people who say, you know, I'm shut in. I don't have the ability to go out and experience live classical music or to go to the theater or to do these things. I only get that in public media. There isn't anywhere on commercial media where you get that same level, those same kinds of programming. People say, well, you can find it anywhere on the internet now. Well, I'm not sure that's true, that the kind of programming that is on our local public television stations can be found anywhere. I'll give you an example. Changing Seas is a locally produced program here in South Florida by South Florida PBS. It's a program that's broadcast nationally. It produces features on the ocean. This isn't Shark Week. This is really in-depth, analytical, documentary-style programming that talks about the marine life and things that are critical to our changing seas. And it features stories here in South Florida and all over the country. So that's just one example of the kind of programming that you know, you can look at it largely and say, well, you know, there are other things on National Geo. Well, there really aren't. Look at the programming and compare it. And I don't think it's comparable.
So shouldn't public radio and TV rely more on ads?
So that's been a question that's been being knocked around since probably the 1980s. And, you know, one of the results of the funding cuts may just be that. Maybe that the FCC and the government says, well, we're going to reduce your funding, but maybe we'll allow you to do more from the standpoint of advertising. It'll be interesting to see how stations react to that. I think some stations will not want to interrupt programming with advertising, which they currently do not do. There are specific guidelines to the sponsorship or underwriting on public broadcasting. Can't be a call to action. You can't have components that you have in advertising. So maybe that's one of the results. I think there are a lot of things that stations are doing in reaction to this funding, and some of them will be really good.
Well, a lot of the sponsorship ads, if you will, that I hear, I can remember some years ago, the ad would be brought to you by so-and-so, period.
And, right.
And now it's brought to you by so-and-so who provides this, that, and the other thing, and 30 seconds later, you feel like you've listened to an entire ad.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that was allowed, frankly. So in one sense, they already do advertising.
Yeah, they do, but there's very strict parameters on those ads. So if you compare them to, say, your average commercial television ad, you'll see distinctions. And I know because I review them for stations, and I say, you know, you can't run this ad, or the advertiser's got to remove this language. It can't be qualitative. You can't have calls to action. There's all kinds of rules that currently apply to public broadcasting. What you're referencing is called enhanced advertising, enhanced underwriting. In the 80s, they came out and said, the FCC said, okay, we're going to allow this enhanced underwriting so long as you follow these parameters, because stations needed to be able to raise more money through sponsorships. And they said, you don't just have to have the billboard. Now, one of the reactions to that was a bunch of conservative stations said, we're not going to do that. So some stations said, okay, we're gonna go ahead and do as much as we can do to raise funds. Others said, well, we just don't think that's appropriate. And so local stations will make their opinion in terms of whether they're going to use enhanced advertising. And if the floodgates open to say you can do any advertising, I think local stations will make that decision as well.
So what is your advice to WXCL and the other Florida stations? What would you tell them to do now?
So I think what I don't have to tell them, but what I can see them doing, which I find exciting, is many stations are being very entrepreneurial. Many stations are looking for ways that they can enhance their purpose, enhance what they're doing and why they're doing it in a way that's going to attract more donors or more profitability. So a really great example of this is South Florida PBS. South Florida PBS took some empty studio space, turned it into an immersive studio, and then to correspond with the Ken Burns PBS documentary on Leonardo da Vinci, they brought in an immersive exhibit on da Vinci. So they took that immersive exhibit, they put it in their studio space. So, you know, an immersive program where people interact with the video, really exciting things. But then they took that and they expanded it to create a whole educational component that went with it. Again, always expanding the mission. And then, so what they did is they sold tickets essentially for, you know, nights and weekends for anyone in the community to come in and a reasonable price to participate in the exhibit and the educational programming. And then they bussed in school kids from all over South Florida to experience the event and the educational components of it. And then they built built educational curriculum to go right into the schools to enhance what the kids were seeing in the exhibit. So I think things like that are really exciting. The fact that public broadcasters are saying, okay, here's the challenge. What's the opportunity for us to change the paradigm? Just yesterday, GBH in Boston, one of the premier broadcasters in the public broadcasting world, announced layoffs. They announced 13 layoffs, particularly related to the production of their program, American Experience, which is a phenomenal, phenomenal program. And so what they've said is, this is an immediate reaction to the funding cuts. You know, we've got to find, you know, a way to balance that. But what we intend to do now is to see how we can enhance our programming digitally. So television and the media is changing. This is a signal to us that we need to really grasp digital media and content and figure out how we can pivot in a way that's going to allow us to expand how we meet our services, how we meet our purpose, but do it in a way that we can afford to do it and not give up any of our services that we provide.
So if you had to make one big change at WXL or any of the other public television radio stations around the country, what would you do?
So the thing is, I don't think there's one big change that fits every station. There are stations in Alaska that get most of their income from the federal government. Those stations are in a critical situation right now. There are stations in South Dakota that are the only source of information for Indian tribes that get 30 to 40, 60% of their revenue from the federal government. Their reaction is going to be much different than a GBH that may only get 6 or 8 or 10% of the funding from the federal government. So I think every station has to adjust for that station. And this puts a big onus on the members of the board of directors. The one thing you have to remember about public broadcasters is their licenses are held by community members. They're held by an organization, a not-for-profit, that has a board of directors, or they may be held by a state or a university. But the onus is then on the leadership to say, how do we exercise our fiduciary responsibility? And who is that fiduciary responsibility to? Is it to the federal government? Is it to the viewer? Well, I say that the fiduciary duty is to your exempt purpose. It's that mission that you're trying to accomplish. And so how is I, as a director in South Florida at South Florida PBS, or in Boston at WGBH, best serve my community? That's really the question that the leadership in local stations has to answer.
Well, the only reason Republicans were able to make this move, both on the state level and the federal level, was because they had support to make these moves. Over the years, what has public broadcasting not done that they needed to do to ensure public support to push back on these kinds of cuts?
So it's interesting. You know, when I was growing up, I would volunteer at Channel 2 in Miami. When I was in high school, I would go into the pledge drives and I'd answer the phones. And when they had auctions, I'd come in and I'd help them move stuff around and just as a regular volunteer activity. You had a lot of community contact in those days at local stations. The pledge drives have really become a minimal aspect. There are no longer auctions or other events. So again, going back to the immersive exhibits at South Florida PBS, the one thing that does is it brings thousands of people into your building. It brings them into a touch point with you where you're not just on the other end of a television station dial anymore. You're not just on a screen, which is seeing maybe diminishing audiences anyway. You're physically interacting with your constituents. And again, like I said, there's so many small slices of, you know, direct contacts in the public broadcasting world, because the whole intent of public broadcasting was not to serve everybody, right? Commercial stations try to serve everyone, get the greatest number of eyeballs they can get. That's not the intent of public media. The intent of public media is to get the best information and entertainment out in a way that meets your needs specifically. So each little audience has their needs met. So you're not going to get the greatest eyeballs. So how do you then reach out and build an upswelling of support? By coming in, by contacting all those people, by having a relationship with those people. And I think public media stations have lost that personal relationship. So hopefully things like the immersive experiences, things like, again, using South Florida PBS in our own backyard as an example, they've built a cultural arts center. So their concept is we're bringing the community back into the station. We're allowing musical entertainment experiences to happen, not just through our broadcasts and through our digital components, but right here physically in our studios in Palm Beach County. Those are the kind of things that I think make public media more real to people, just everyday people, when you have those touchstones. For parents, you know, those kids programs are really instrumental to those formative years. When my daughter was growing up, I trusted PBS. PBS is the most trusted source of media in our country. There's a reason for that. Local stations need to take advantage of that and build that trust that exists on the other end of the television screen with greater contact.
So you grew up in Broward County?
I did.
Tell me about it.
So I grew up like a lot of Floridians. You know, my my parents came down from New York, New Jersey. I had a great childhood. Most of the people I grew up with were, you know, transplanted from somewhere else. You know, none of us were from Florida. So that was kind of a shared experience. I just, you know, enjoyed growing up in a community where Miami was at, you know, a stone's throw away. Fort Lauderdale was a stone's throw away. And I could really experience culture through that. You know, my dad was a salesman. So he had friends all over South Florida. So it wasn't any big deal for us to go down to Little Havana and have dinner with some of his friends or even, you know, Overtown and experience, you know, cultures that were very different than my own. So I loved growing up in South Florida.
Has it changed any since you were a kid?
Wow. We have a lot more concrete. There are a lot more roads. There are a lot more people. I think at the core, you know, South Florida is a very diverse community. And, you know, I think that's a great thing. I think the fact that we can experience all kinds of cultures and people, you know, makes it a wonderful place to kind of learn and socialize, you know, not just being in a vacuum.
So when you graduated from high school, you went to the University of Florida.
I did, yep. Went to the journalism school like Michael. Yeah.
Were you classmates?
No.
How'd you like UF?
I loved it. It was a great experience. It was a great opportunity. My first actual job in public media was as an intern at the public radio station at University of Florida. That's where I really learned about media and public media. It was a great experience.
And is that what led you to WXEL?
Yeah, when I graduated from college, you know, out of journalism school, I didn't want to go into journalism right then. I thought, let me try something different. And I, you know, put a list of like the places I'd really like to work. And, you know, a lot of it, about half of them were nonprofits. And including on that list was WPBT in Miami. And so I reached out to them, and they actually hired me, and that's how I began that journey.
Hired you to do what?
I was in marketing and membership.
Okay, yeah. All right. And yeah. How'd that work out?
Worked out pretty well. When I eventually moved up to WXEL, and at the point that I was a vice president there doing television and radio, there was an underwriting spot on our air from Nova, that they were opening an evening program for their law school. So I had always thought about going to law school, just couldn't afford it right out of college and needed to work. And so, you know, 15 years or so later, when I heard that, I said, you know, maybe now's a good time. My wife was starting a master's program at Lynn University in education. And I thought, well, if she's not gonna be home at night, I might as well do something. So I went back to law school. I worked full-time at WXEL during the day. And
so you're in your mid-30s when you ventured law school.
I was in my mid-30s, that's right.
So you're working full-time during the day,
yeah.
Going to law school at night.
Right.
Would you sleep 2 hours a night?
Yeah, so it's kind of pretty much. Yeah.
That must have been rough.
No, you know, it's like anything else. When you know, everyone has their experiences. They do what you do, and while you're doing it, you're not thinking about it. You're just doing it. So it was just very common for me to get to work at 8:30. Usually I try to leave by 4:30 so that I could get through the traffic down to Fort Lauderdale. I'd be in school usually until 10 or 11 at night. Then I'd go to the library for an hour or two. I'd grab dinner and a drive-thru on my way home to West Palm Beach. And then I'd study for an hour or two and do it all over again.
Yeah. So are you that guy that had the do not disturb sign on your WXEL door so that you could do your ANOVA homework while you were in the office?
No, honestly, to tell you the truth, when I started law school, I said, listen, I don't need to be at the top of the class. I'm probably not going to ever practice law. I'm probably just going to stay in the public media world and kind of work my way through that. So I didn't care what my grades were. So I said, you know, I'm gonna do the best I can. And if I don't finish the reading and I don't get everything done, so be it. And so it got to a certain point where, you know, if I didn't get the reading done and the professor called on me, the old Socratic method, I just said, sorry, I don't know the answer, and got yelled at and moved on. And if I got lucky,
done that.
if I got lucky, my pager from work went off and I had to go run out and call the Palm Beach Post who was calling me or something like that, right? I didn't put pressure on myself. And so, you know, the result is when you don't put pressure on yourself, you do pretty well. So, and my journalism background, by the way, helped a lot for law school.
Well, I bet.
Because all your exams pretty much are essays. And the one thing you learn about a law school essay is you write the way you write a journalism story. Everything you tell the facts up front, most important information, and then at the end you just weed in whatever else you need to put in. So, you know, it was the upside down pyramid style of writing essays that got me through law school.
Well, I know that there's a lot of judges who wish lawyers could write as well as you do.
it's a wonderful skill to have, and I am very appreciative of my journalism background.
Are you going to be replaced by AI pretty soon?
So it's really interesting because we're looking at AI and how to use it, you know, in the legal profession, and there's all kinds of messages out there about that. And my favorite saying is that, and you can use this for any profession, AI will make a good lawyer better and will expose a bad lawyer.
Interesting.
Yeah. And there have been a number of lawyers who have been exposed already by using AI and submitting briefs to courts, which had hallucinations in the briefs because the information was generated by AI and not confirmed by the lawyer.
Okay, this may be the toughest question you've ever had. Which is better? The Dodge Charger or the Ford Mustang?
Oh, yes. You already know the answer to that question. I'm a big Ford Mustang person, absolutely.
What made you a Mustang guy?
You know, when I was growing up, a good friend of my family had a Mustang, a convertible Mustang, and I just fell in love with it. So I've always loved Mustangs and would love to have a 67 Mustang, but in lieu of that, I've gone with the electric Mustang for now.
And so what do you think of the modern Mustangs compared to the ones you saw growing up?
You know what? I prefer the muscle cars of the 60s, but the new Mustangs are pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Have you seen the Dark Horse Mustang they just, you know, brought out? It's awesome. The new Mustangs are great. They really are. My preference is still the old 60s, again, like a 67, 68. Love to have a stick shift, right? Yeah. But honestly, I love the old Fox bodies, you know, the old Fox bodies from the 80s. You know, I had the first new car I ever bought was a convertible Mustang, black, and it was a Fox body because it was in the mid-80s. I'm a big Mustang fan.
That's great. Well, thank you for being here. Appreciate your insight. You know, you're one of the best-known nonprofit attorneys and highly regarded, and I'm sure your work for WXAL will help dig them out of the mess that they happen to be in, South Florida PBS. And thank you very much, Phil, for being here.
I appreciate the opportunity.
And thank you for watching, and please subscribe and let us know what you think. Thanks once again from Top of Mind, Florida.